Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Cure Talks. This is Shweta Mishra, your host, and today we are talking about legal aspects of navigating through cancer diagnosis and treatment with Shelley Rosenfeld, co-director of the Disability Rights Legal Center's Cancer Legal Resource Center. As co-director, Shelley provides legal services through CLRC's National Telephone Assistance Line to people having to deal with cancer-related legal issues, counseling cancer patients, healthcare professionals, and caregivers. Welcome to the Cure Talks, Shelley. It's my pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
On the panel, we have multiple myeloma patient advocates Matt Goldman and Cynthia Schmalewski. Matt was diagnosed with myeloma in 2011 and advocates by documenting his journey on his website, mattversusmyeloma.com. Cindy on the panel sits on the advisory boards of the Patient Empowerment Network and Myeloma Crowd and the Philadelphia Multiple Myeloma Networking Group, and she educates and advocates via tweeting at Myeloma Teacher and posting on her Myeloma Teacher Facebook page. Matt and Cindy, thank you so much for joining us today. Before we begin, I would like to tell our audience that we will be discussing questions sent in via email in the last few minutes of the call, so you can send your questions to shweta@trilex.com or post them on the page where you are listening to the show right now, and we'll be answering them based on the availability of time. With that, I'll hand over to Matt now to begin with his questions for Shelley. Matt, it's all yours.
Thanks, Shweta, and thanks, Shelley, for your time. So my first question is, with offices reopening in various places right now, what are the rights of cancer patients or anyone with a lowered immunity who just doesn't feel safe going back to the office or work environment?
Sure, that's a great question, Matt. And Matt and Cindy, thank you so much for your activism. So, well, first of all, it's very realistic that with offices reopening up, it's a very difficult situation for someone with cancer who has concerns given that they have lowered immunity. And it's also a little bit difficult as we're only coming to understand COVID-19 to understand a lot of the implications of, you know, and the disease itself and the implications for those with cancer. So first of all, you know, a very natural question is, can an employee stay home under, for example, the Family Medical Leave Act or the FMLA to avoid getting the COVID-19 illness? So the FMLA, that protects eligible employees who are incapacitated by serious health condition, and that could be the case if somebody has, you know, COVID-19. But leave taken by an employee for the purpose of avoiding exposure to COVID-19 would not be protected under the Family Medical Leave Act. So basically, if someone actually wants to take time off of work or rather to work remotely, which is, you know, a change in the kind of workspace, telecommuting from home, working from a different location, that type of request is an example of a potential reasonable accommodation under the ADA. So, you know, first of all, you know, somebody might be thinking of the FMLA. That likely won't be as effective. Rather, the American with Disabilities Act, asking for a reasonable accommodation may actually be successful. Now, I want to note that, first of all, most people going through cancer treatment, or even, you know, just having a compromised immune system, you know, they may not know, and nobody really actually knows when COVID-19 will expire or end. So the challenge with asking this, and I would urge anyone who's considering doing this, really consider that because there's no official end date, when there's no more COVID-19 and things are so uncertain, a request to work remotely without an official end date may not be seen as a reasonable accommodation because some employers may claim it's an undue hardship. In other words, working from home just with no specific end date might be a lot to ask for an employer to agree to. Not, I wouldn't say that the employee should not ask, but just to kind of see it from the employer's perspective, they may want to have a conversation about when might be a projected end date, and the person with cancer should not be intimidated by that, but rather have maybe an assessment of, hey, you know, let's think about this for the next X amount of time. And that's really dependent on the person themselves and how comfortable they feel, and then perhaps revisiting that conversation with their employer. But just saying, you know, with no end date, that might be a little bit tougher of a conversation to have. But the benefit is that because of this situation, a lot of employers that might have not have otherwise considered remote work have seen that this can be doable. So if there's a time to ask, it's if you're already, you know, have been working remotely and you're doing a good job, an employer may consider that in a more positive light, given the circumstances that it has been working so far.
All right. Thanks. Yeah, it seems like COVID has changed everything in terms of work. Now, if someone isn't really comfortable how their employer or human resources is implementing FMLA or ADA requirements, is this something that your organization, somebody could call and get a little bit of assistance with?
Absolutely, yes. You know, one of the most common issues that people will contact the Cancer Legal Resource Center or the CLRC is related to employer-related issues. So I would strongly urge anyone that wants more specific information to contact the CLRC at 866-THE-CLRC or clrcintake.org. Everything is free and confidential. There aren't many times when someone can get legal resources for free, tailored to their specific situation, and that it's, you know, certainly in general when you're speaking to a lawyer, it's confidential, but the fact that it's free and tailored for that person's set of circumstances, I think, is something really quite extraordinary. And we help people from all over the United States. It's not just one state. So I would definitely suggest that people reach out to us. And certainly, you know, the extension of, for example, if someone needs to take time off for FMLA, you know, if we would talk to them and to help them figure out if they're a covered employee, whether it applies to their employer, and then, you know, the time that they may be able to take off, and then if they need additional time, figuring out how that could be a reasonable accommodation potentially.
Awesome. Thank you. Switching gears a little bit, for patients who might consider medical marijuana to counter some of the side effects of their treatment or chemo, are there any rights or exceptions if their jobs require drug testing?
That's a really great question and a very hot topic. So, we kind of say that there is some sort of like a grass ceiling to just like think about it creatively. So employers are allowed to maintain policies regarding drug-free workplaces, and understandably, most employers have rules about drug or alcohol use during the workday or on the premises. So in most cases, for example, an employee who's seeking first-time employment can be tested as a condition of employment, even if there's no cause or reason to believe that the prospective employee has been taking drugs. So it's really something to be aware of. The employer, however, must test all incoming employees for drugs and cannot single that person out for special treatment. So some states have imposed limitations on pre-employment drug testing. So, for example, California allows a drug test only after the applicant has received an offer of employment conditioned on passing the test. So, you know, one other thing to consider, and I reference the American with Disabilities Act, or the ADA, and it does protect employees with disabilities from discrimination by certain employers based on their disability. And, you know, if we have the opportunity to get into it more later, I'll talk a little bit about that and how cancer can be considered a disability. But, you know, an important thing to consider is that since the ADA is a federal law, it treats marijuana as an illegal drug, not as a medication, even if, understandably, someone is using it for medicinal purposes. So under the ADA, current illegal drug use and I, you know, use illegal with quotation marks, is not protected as, you know, a disability. So medical marijuana use alone is not enough to entitle someone to a reasonable accommodation. So, you know, just to raise the fact of like someone, you know, can be tested in advance, and it's not something where it's protected if somebody needs it, understandably, to combat some of the side effects of their treatment. So under the ADA, employers are not required to alter their drug-free workplace policies in order to accommodate a worker who uses medical marijuana, even if they're using it under a doctor's recommendation. So it's definitely an issue that's a very hot topic. And, you know, we've actually done separate presentations just on medical marijuana. So certainly it's something that, you know, someone can feel free to reach out to the CLRC with a little bit more information, because certainly it's definitely an emerging issue and things are changing all the time.
Right. Wow. Thank you. And then my final question is, what assistance do you provide, or what rights do cancer patients have who are having challenges paying their rent or paying their mortgages, aside from, you know, what some places are offering for COVID, but specifically, you know, if you're off on FMLA or dealing with your cancer, is there any resource out there for a patient?
Sure. That's a really, really great question. And I won't talk about COVID-19 protections, because let's face it, someone with cancer, you know, COVID may be less of an issue, and certainly the protections may be going away for rent and mortgages related to COVID-19. But someone with cancer isn't just going to end for people. So it's certainly something to really keep in mind. So first of all, breaking a lease, you know, due to a medical condition. If someone needs to break a lease early because they're unable to pay rent and need to move out, unfortunately, there is not usually a clause in the lease that allows it to be broken for medical reasons, or a law that allows one to do that. So first of all, I would certainly suggest someone to check their lease, but just kind of flagging it that it's probably not in there, that would be very rare. And, you know, if someone were to examine the lease, they may want to also, you know, talk to a lawyer that can help them understand a little bit more. But, you know, one other option is if a lease doesn't state that it, you know, doesn't allow subletting, that could be an option as well if somebody, you know, needs financial support for that. Also, negotiating with a landlord might work as well. You know, a person has to feel that situation out. But for those having difficulty making their monthly mortgage payments, which is really understandable given unemployment, medical treatment, or any, you know, a host of other sudden changes that can make it difficult to meet financial obligations, you know, first of all, I would say don't ignore the problem, and a person should take action to avoid foreclosure. So, you know, foreclosure, just to bring everybody up to speed, is the legal process through which a lender attempts to recover a debt that's not being paid, by, you know, taking possession of a loan's collateral, meaning the house, and selling it. So that's what we want to avoid, is the lender being able to repossess the home and reselling it. So forbearance agreements, that's one option. If somebody's having difficulty making payments because of a temporary change and needs some short-term relief, a forbearance agreement, entering into that with the lender agrees to allow the person to reduce or miss their mortgage payments for a specific amount of time, which they call the forbearance period, and not to foreclose on the home during this time. But at the end of that period, the person may have to pay additional money to make up for what they didn't pay. So that's an option to keep in the back pocket. But let's face it, someone who has financial troubles, it might not be just something that's solvable within a few months or a specific period of time, but just to know that that's an option. Loan modifications is another option. That's a permanent change to the terms of the mortgage to make it easier for someone to keep up with payments. So what's an example of a loan modification? Could be reducing the interest rate or extending the term of a loan. So for example, if someone had a 20-year mortgage, $1,000 in payments every month, they might be able to extend the mortgage from 20 years to 30 years. And that would reduce the monthly payment by a few hundred dollars per month. You know, it depends really for a person based on their mortgage loan agreement, whether that's possible in that person's situation. But it's important to know what options are there. And the person would likely have to show that they can't make current payments based on financial hardship and may also need to prove that eventually they would be able to. One other option is, so if, you know, if someone missed a few payments because of a temporary hardship, a repayment plan can help the person catch up on those payments after they've gotten their finances back in order. So there might be a repayment plan that they'll total the amount that the person owes and divide the debt over a certain number of months. So the person would pay that amount back in addition to their normal payments. And then after that repayment period, they'd go back to making their normal payments. So in, you know, if any of these options, you know, make sense, I would certainly recommend that someone contacts their lender's loss mitigation department as soon as possible. And, you know, there might also, one other option is to, you know, if the person has missed more than four but less than 12 mortgage payments, they may be able to work with their lender to file a partial claim with Housing and Urban Development Office for a loan from the Federal Housing Agency's insurance fund for the total amount of payments they've missed. But this is only an option if the person's able to begin making full payments in their mortgage again. So I mentioned that last because really the person that might be thinking of this, they can't make payments right now and really need to think about, okay, what can they do and what can they work out with their lender? So, but if anything, during this time, people are more aware of the sudden change of a medical situation and everybody's feeling an effect in some way. So I think, you know, it's, a person should not be shy about thinking of proactively of a solution.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. That was really good information. That's all I have. Thank you again, Shelley, and I'll hand it over to Cindy.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Matt. Cindy, please go ahead with your questions.
Yes. Okay. Thank you so much. My gosh, what you're saying is so informative. I wish I knew some of this years ago. But can we just take a step back for our listeners who may not be familiar with all these acronyms and terminologies and talk a little bit about what the American with Disabilities Act is, or the ADA? Is cancer considered a disability under this? And does the ADA apply to all employers? And we talked a little bit about the reasonable workplace accommodations. And could you just give some examples of what could be accommodation for a cancer patient? And finally, in that whole ADA discussion, like, if you're asking for accommodations, how should that discussion be started? A face-to-face talk with your employer, an email, should you have someone going in to represent you? Just, you know, I guess an ADA primer I'm asking you to give us.
Sure. Well, hopefully we'll be able to cover a lot of ground, and I think the ADA is a really important law that can offer a lot of protections for people, so it's definitely worth going through. So the ADA stands for the American with Disabilities Act, and this is a federal law that makes it illegal for private employers, and you asked about the definition of employers that would apply, with 15 or more employees, it makes it illegal for them to discriminate against qualified job applicants or qualified employees with disabilities in any stage of the employment process. So under the ADA, to go to one of the other parts of your question, a disability is defined as a mental or physical impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. And cancer or the effects of cancer can be a disability under the ADA because they might substantially impair major life activities such as eating, sleeping, or concentrating. So the ADA also protects people with histories of disabilities and people who are regarded as having disabilities, including serious health conditions like cancer. So it's certainly something where it's not specifically defined. Some states go beyond that and actually list cancer as a disability. Not every state does that, but we're talking about the federal law, which is kind of the baseline, and that applies, you know, to all the states, and that makes it illegal to discriminate against someone with a disability. And again, cancer can be defined as a disability. So an example of a reasonable accommodation. So they can range anywhere from making change to the physical environment, such as, for example, moving file drawers to a more accessible location, or changing the way that someone works, such as giving time to recover from a treatment, or, you know, as we touched upon earlier, allowing someone to temporarily work remotely or call remotely into meetings. Whether an employer has to give the person a type of accommodation they're trying to get depends on whether it would be an undue hardship, and that's a term, like it's a specific phrase, undue hardship on the employer. Being an undue hardship, the definition of that, just in kind of layman's terms, is that it will cost the employer too much to give the person the accommodation. But what costs too much really depends on the specific job and the specific employer at issue. For example, what might be easier to do for one employer may actually be really difficult for another. And let's face it, if someone has a job that requires them to stand, suppose they're working on, you know, an assembly line and it's for some reason the job does not allow for them to sit down, but that's what they need. You know, that's a different conversation than perhaps someone that their usual work involves sitting at a desk. So certainly asking for maybe a more supportive chair because they're having body aches, that would be perhaps, you know, way easier to ask. When to have the discussion. So in terms of having the discussion with the employer, that is such a personal decision. People have a wide variety of levels of comfort about talking about their medical situation. And really, you know, there's not one way to approach it, and a person should feel good with whatever approach they most feel comfortable making, because it's really about them and what they want to do. What we do usually tell people, just in terms of the framework of jobs, is to ask for accommodations before work performance starts to suffer. Because if your performance suffers at work, an employer may take negative action against you if they don't know you have a disability or need for accommodation. So, just to give an example, if an employer sees an employee sleeping at his or her desk, they can be terminated. However, if the employee decides to ask for reasonable accommodation under the ADA and tells the employer that they have fatigue from cancer treatment, or they don't even have to say cancer treatment, they can be more vague and say, you know, medical treatment or whatever, and need more frequent breaks due to fatigue before the employer has a chance to see them sleeping on the job, the employee has more protection at work. So just to underscore, it is a personal decision. But if the person knows their work performance will suffer, asking for accommodation or a person saying they have a disability at the moment, you know, is being proactive, because once the person is terminated for poor performance, it's usually too late. And just to kind of bring up one more point, if the especially given just the circumstances right now, if the person's asking to work remotely as a reasonable accommodation, which, you know, seems like that would be a common one that people might be considering right now, just to underscore, it's important to keep in mind that an employer is always going to say that extending leave with no definite return date, it may be an undue hardship. So when making an accommodations request, think about asking for a specific number of additional days and then revisiting it, because, you know, you want to prevent the employer from saying an undue hardship. Now, you may say, okay, I'm not sure when it'll return, and the employer may say, no, it's not an undue hardship, but, you know, it leads the conversation in a certain direction if the person says, I don't know, which is also reasonable because we don't know in terms of COVID-19 and a variety of other situations out there. It's not completely in a person's control, whereas before maybe somebody needed to work remotely because of cancer treatment, and then once that would finish, perhaps they would be in a better position to return to work. So it's something to consider, to keep in mind what is, from the employee's perspective, what do they feel comfortable asking, and then seeing if the employer will agree to revisit it based on how the employee is performing at work and also the current situation globally, or certainly in that person's state, for COVID-19.
Okay, thanks so much. I do have a couple follow-up questions to that. Should requests for accommodations be done in writing, or is a conversation enough? And if your accommodation request is denied, is there an appeal process?
That's a really good question in terms of whether it should be done in writing. Again, this is something that is, you know, up to the person whether they want to have that conversation in, you know, with their boss and how it comes up organically. I mean, it could be something where if the person may want to be very careful with how they present it. So perhaps putting it in writing would be more effective. You know, if there's a boss that, you know, and they want to have, and they have a certain comfort level with the boss and they want the boss to be able to ask certain questions in person and, you know, perhaps reassure the boss, then that could be something that is more conducive to an in-person conversation. And then, you know, to gain the benefits of maybe having it spelled out clearly, then perhaps the employee can then summarize the conversation and a few bullet points and ask the employer if they agree that that's their understanding of the conversation as well. So that's just kind of a handy tip in terms of if the person themselves says, you know, I'd really like to have this conversation in person. It kind of takes the edge off of what's a difficult conversation. They can see the sincerity in my face or hear the sincerity in my voice. And, you know, I can reassure the employer that I'm going to be doing my job. I just need, you know, a few changes. You know, then that's something that might be more comfortable to do in person. But, you know, it certainly would be a good idea perhaps to afterwards to sum it up. But there's nothing wrong with doing it in writing as well if that employee feels comfortable in terms of framing it that way and kind of being able to control a little bit more of what they're sharing with the employer. So, you know, just to keep in mind, you know, that those different parameters. And you're asking if there's an appeals process. Now, you know, that's actually even before, I want to back up for a second and say the conversation about reasonable accommodations, it's not like it's a one-shot deal where somebody will say something and the employer says something and conversation over. It's a lot of times it's a ongoing conversation. What I mean is somebody saying, you know, they might have an idea of what kind of accommodations they need. And, you know, the employer says, you know, I'm sorry, I can't give you an indefinite amount of time to work remotely. This is not, you know, we need this. We need you to be here. You're a boss. We need you to lead meetings. And the employee says, you know, I totally understand. You know, how about 90 days? Let's see where we are in 90 days. So you see that there's, you could say, okay, well, the first conversation is a denial. And they're saying it's an undue hardship. Well, you know, that doesn't mean that the conversation's over. It just means, well, maybe there's a way that the two parties can work it out. So, you know, the question of, okay, well, if it's, you know, if the employer, if the employer just says, okay, if it really isn't able to be worked out, if it, there are situations where it just doesn't work out, or, you know, the person is, let's say, fired because of, you know, a variety of circumstances, and then they call the CLRC or, you know, they decide to kind of see whatever, what something else that they can do. Well, there are organizations out there. If somebody believes that they've been discriminated against in the workplace or have questions about anti-discrimination protections, the CLRC, we have handouts on our website about a person's right to be free from discrimination in the workplace. We'd also suggest that someone speaks with an employment attorney to discuss their legal options if they face discrimination. And another option is to file a complaint with the EEOC. The EEOC stands for Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And then a person can certainly bring a claim for a violation of the ADA, the American Disabilities Act, file a claim with their state fair employment agency. That's determined, you know, each state has their own fair employment agency, or bring a lawsuit against their employer. There's also something called the Job Accommodation Network, or JAN, and that's a service of the U.S. Department of Labor's Office of Disability Employment Policy. So that also provides some helpful information about navigating that discussion with the employer. But I think you bring up a good point, because just because an employer might say, okay, well, that doesn't work for me, you don't have to necessarily think of it as, okay, case closed, you know, denial, I have to kind of go another way. Continue that conversation with your employer, because ultimately, you know, a person likely wants to keep their job so they can pay for treatment, so they can have health insurance. you know, and pay for a whole host of other aspects of life. So try to make it work with the employer before thinking about these other options. But in some cases, unfortunately, you know, a person is treated differently or something can't be worked out. And then, you know, but just because, you know, a person asks for something and the employer says no, it might not be the end of the conversation. And in some cases, maybe the employee's asking for something that's just not feasible for that employer. It costs too much. It's just not doable. So a person also has to be understanding that, like, that, you know, sometimes life circumstances change and the employer just can't make that happen for them.
Okay. Thanks so much. So I've got a better understanding of the ADA. Now let's try to tackle disability insurance.
Sure.
First of all, like, what is disability insurance? And there's so many different kinds. There's like a short-term disability, a long-term. There's social security disability. Some are policies you pay for. Some are state policies, I believe. Can you just give us an overview of disability insurance?
Sure. And you're asking really great topics. And as I hope listeners will hear, that there's so many topics that are relevant when someone faces cancer. So certainly they should reach out to us with any kinds of questions that come up. So going through and just giving an overview, because there is so much information out there. Short-term private disability insurance is sometimes, you know, abbreviated short-term disability or STD insurance. That pays a percentage of a person's salary if they become unable to work for a short period of time due to illness, injury, or pregnancy. Short-term disability insurance policies typically provide benefits for short periods of time, like 6 months or 1 year. Long-term private disability insurance, or, you know, long-term disability or LTD insurance, pays a percentage of a person's salary if they become unable to work for a longer period due to illness, injury, or pregnancy. Long-term disability insurance policies provide benefits for a disability that's expected to last, or let's say has lasted, for a year or longer. And they vary, you know, the different plans vary on the length of coverage, but they may provide coverage for a limited number of years, or they may provide benefits until age 65 or until retirement or until recovery. So, you know, just to kind of put it out there that, you know, it certainly ranges, but that's just a brief overview of those. To kind of switch to Social Security Administration, they're in charge of two federal benefit programs, SSDI and SSI. They both, just to start with what they have in common, they both have the same definition of disability. The person must be unable to work due to a severe medical condition that's expected to last at least 1 year or to result in death. SSI, that stands for Supplemental Security Income. That's based on assets and income, not work history. So that's more just, you know, when you think about financial aspects. SSDI, which is Social Security Disability Insurance, that's based on work history. So a person must have earned 40, and I put in quotation, work credits, because that's a term, including at least 20 over the last 10 years. A work credit is currently defined as earning $1,410 in wages or self-employment income. 4 work credits can be accrued per year. Younger patients have lower requirements. After 2 years of receiving SSDI, if person's under 65, the person would be eligible to receive Medicare. And, you know, in terms of applying for it, a person has to show that the medical condition is keeping them from working or earning substantial gainful activity. And, you know, it's important to let your doctor know that you're applying. They'll know what SSA, meaning the Social Security Administration, looks for, and will make sure to take appropriate notes that accurately reflect your inability to work. Also, it's a good idea to list multiple conditions if a person has them. If a person has multiple things contributing to their inability to work beyond cancer, they should list them all. And one other thing to consider is that there's something called the Compassionate Allowances Program. That contains a list of medical conditions that allow for review in days as opposed to months. And if the person's condition falls on that list, they should look. They should write in compassionate allowances somewhere on the application for benefits. So just even if there's no box to check off, a person should write the word compassionate allowances if they would qualify. And if the person's applying for SSDI, there's still a 5-month wait period, but the application will be reviewed sooner. So just to kind of, you know, put in perspective, the application will be reviewed sooner. There will still be a waiting period to actually receive benefits, but the application will get looked at sooner, which is, you know, very important. So, you know, certainly something to be aware of.
Okay, great. Now, are there any states that have like a state disability insurance, or are all short-term and long-term private policies?
Oh, that's a good question.
Sometimes I think out of my checks, there used to be disability insurance. So is that something?
Yes. For specific state questions, I would definitely say, you know, a person should turn to the CLRC. We have resources for each person's state. I don't know offhand, and I also get cautious about just kind of thinking about states, and but the person may be, you know, it would be a good idea for them to reach out to us to get a little bit more information about their specific state and what additional protections there are for that person. So that's a really good question. But just generally, you know, we would first start off with, you know, whether they qualify for federal disability, and then kind of see if there are additional resources from the states. Because after all, the federal law, which we've been going over today for a lot of different topics, is a baseline. But a lot of states maybe offering more, or, you know, just to kind of bring it back to the ADA, some states will say, you know, the employer doesn't have to have 15 or more employees. They can have fewer employees. So, you know, it's definitely something worth going over for that person's specific state in terms of whether there are additional protections. But, you know, at least if somebody's aware of the federal protections, they know at least they'll get this potentially and maybe more.
Okay, great. So we talked about disability insurance. How about health insurance? Can a person be denied health insurance because they are diagnosed with cancer? If you have to leave your job, could you explain what COBRA is? And, you know, and the American, the ACA, and, like, how do you choose between COBRA and ACA? Just anything, any wisdom on health insurance that you could give us.
Sure. So the ACA stands for the Affordable Care Act. It's also known as Obamacare. And it actually, before the ACA, health insurance could charge a person more or deny them coverage altogether if they had a pre-existing condition, such as cancer. So that's why a lot of people still might be confused. Okay, well, you know, what about a pre-existing condition? You know, people don't always think about cancer until they get it. So, and then they're thinking, okay, well, how will this impact my health insurance? However, as of January 1st, 2014, health insurance companies are no longer allowed to take a person's medical status into consideration when determining whether to insure the person and or how much to charge. But just to kind of, you know, give the clearest picture, health insurance companies are now only able to consider four things when setting premium rates: age, geographic location, number of people insured, and in some states, tobacco use. So, you know, it's important to recognize that, a person's insurance company charges might differ based on those factors, but pre-existing conditions will not be an issue. Health insurance companies are not allowed to take medical status into consideration. COBRA. COBRA stands for Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act. So you can understand why people really don't say that full name, but they say COBRA. So that's a federal law that requires a group health insurance plan to provide continuation of health insurance benefits. COBRA, in other words, allows a person to keep the same health insurance policy that they had when they were employed. So they don't have to worry about changing providers, meaning changing doctors. It's expensive, but for someone with cancer, it may be the best option if someone really doesn't want to switch a doctor or, you know, medical networks. COBRA applies to all group health plans maintained by state or local, not federal governments, and applies to private sector employers of 20 or more employees. So, you know, just to kind of put it out there that, you know, it may be an option for someone. Life can be so unpredictable with jobs. And if someone has a cancer diagnosis, the last thing they may want to do if they're happy with their doctor is to change things up. So COBRA is a very good option to consider if a sudden change in someone's employment, and they want to keep, they are able to pay kind of the employer's share of what the employer had previously been paying, and, you know, want to keep everything the same. So it's definitely worth considering, you know, as an option.
And COBRA, is there a certain amount of time that you have to sign up for that, and can you keep it forever? Or I thought there were like certain things with COBRA that is there. Do you understand my question?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, so COBRA, how long does COBRA last? It doesn't last forever. It extends from the date of the qualifying event. Qualifying event could be, for example, losing a job. That's not the only qualifying event. It extends for a period of 18 or 36 months. And that length of time depends on the qualifying event that gave rise to the COBRA eligibility. And it may also, in some states, provide additional protections. So it does range, but it won't be less than 18 months. But that's a good point in the sense that it's not a permanent solution, but it can get someone through a time and give them, you know, time to consider, okay, well, what's next?
Right, and there's like a period of time you have to sign up for COBRA. Is that correct? Or
yes, right. There is a period of time, and I'm just trying to think exactly. I don't want to say something that's inaccurate. So certainly, if somebody has been, you know, terminated, or you know, wants to look into that, please, you know, reach out to the CLSD. We'll be happy to provide a little bit more information.
Okay, now let's talk about life insurance. Can someone diagnosed with cancer purchase a life insurance policy?
So buying, that's a really good question. Buying life insurance after a cancer diagnosis is challenging, but it's not necessarily impossible. The chances for securing a policy can really depend on the type of cancer, stage of cancer. So it's, you know, it's not one size fits all, but it can even depend on the treatment plan. And there is a relationship between the rate that a person will receive and the curability of that person's cancer. So, in other words, applicants with common and treatable forms of breast cancer and prostate cancer may be able to get a standard rating under ideal circumstances, but patients, you know, with a cancer that's more aggressive or, you know, a different type of cancer may fall into a different rating and actually even be declined. So, or, you know, someone has a cancer that has metastasized, that would be really an uphill battle to get it. I don't want to say absolutes because a person, if that's something a person wants to do, they pursue it. I'm just trying to give a sense of the landscape and, you know, and whether that's something realistic. Also, you know, insurers may not offer a policy to someone who's still undergoing treatment. So it's something to think about. Could be after treatment that might be helpful. And if a person, you know, if a person wants to save the most money when purchasing life insurance, I would say shop around. Prices and rates can really vary depending on the company. So the more a person compares policies, the better the chances are that the person can find a lower premium. Start bigger. Search larger life insurance companies first, then start looking at smaller ones. And, you know, they might have a better sense to kind of differentiate. A larger insurance company may be able to differentiate between different types of cancer, which could actually work in someone's benefit. And then one more thing, if a person is involved in a professional, membership, political, or fraternal organization, check to see if that group offers life insurance. So some organizations can provide a group policy that provides a basic amount of life insurance. And so that coverage can also be a guarantee issue without requiring any medical information. The group and policy may or may not require proof of insurability. So it's just another option to consider. And then, you know, if a person is turned down by life insurance policy because of health reasons, they can look to purchase a graded policy, which is a policy with limited benefits. So I know we don't have all the time in the world, but I just wanted to flag that as well.
Okay. So it's obvious that you need an expert to help you navigate through this. Now we have the Cancer Legal Resource Center that could help us. What are some, like, local places or, you know, other – you had mentioned them earlier, like different – maybe a workplace lawyer or where should people be seeking this advice from?
Sure. Well, I would definitely say that, you know, a good place to start, because so many of the resources, for example, somebody comes to us from a state, we will have legal aid organizations that are in that person's local area. And in some cases, a lawyer has been a member of our professional panel, so they're licensed in that person's state. They've agreed to volunteer half an hour of their time for a free consultation for that person, and you know, have a specialty in that type of law, let's say landlord-tenant or employment. And in that case, we'd also refer to that person too. So I would strongly urge someone to contact us. We can be a good way to say, okay, well, here are the resources in the state that can help. Here's a federal law that may apply. And here are some legal aid organizations that will help you. Now, in certain cases, you know, a person, for example, with a job can apply to EEOC. That's a federal, you know, that's federal. So that would apply for any state. But a lot of times, you know, a good place to start is a legal aid organization. So finding one in a person's area, that could be daunting, but we will do the research for you. It's all free. So we definitely suggest someone reaching out to us for specific state resources that would help in their specific situation.
Well, thank you. You gave us a wonderful overview, a lot of material to digest. So they were all my questions. Sweta, do we have any callers or questions that were written in?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Cindy. Thank you, Matt. It was wonderful listening to your discussion with Shelley and learning so much. And we had quite a few questions emailed to us for Shelley, but I think we have answered most of them. There's one question which asks about advanced healthcare directives, Shelley. So the person lives in CA and she asks, I've heard about advanced healthcare directives. What are they? If you could, you know, shed some light on it.
Sure. And I take it based on CA, they're probably in California. So, you know, I'm a little bit more familiar with California resources offhand. So advanced healthcare directives, that's an important point. And it just shows that there's so many topics that come into play when someone faces cancer or just in general that are worth talking about. So advanced healthcare directives are written instructions that state a person's wishes about the medical care and treatment they want to get if they're unable to make decisions medically for themselves. So a reason someone would get advanced healthcare directive, it's intended to avoid unwanted care, reduce suffering, and ensure that a person's wishes are honored at the end of their life. It can actually be really empowering to think about. It doesn't have to be kind of this dark, dismal topic. A person can say, you know what, I really hope I'm never in this situation, but if I am, here's what I'd like to have happen. So person, for example, can say their desire is about life-sustaining or life-prolonging pain relief. In California, a lot of these, when we think of advanced planning, are state-specific. So, but there might be common aspects in different states, but in California, just by way of example, there's about four parts to an advanced healthcare directive. A power of attorney for healthcare, for example, an agent or patient advocate, instructions, healthcare, like a living will, something with regards to organ donation, whether someone wants to have organ donation or not, that's an important question to think about before, and primary mm-hmm. physician identification. So a living will that I just referred to now is also called a directive to physicians. That's just the part of the document that lets people state end-of-life medical care in case they're unable to communicate their decisions. It has no power after death. It's really designed for just if a person is no longer able to communicate their wishes, that those wishes would be taken and governing that situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Good to know.
I have a follow-up to that.
Sure. Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm wondering, all those things that you're saying, are, do you have to hire an attorney to come up with your advanced healthcare directives? Are there some websites where you can make your own, and would they be honored? I'm just wondering about that, like for people who might not be able to afford an attorney.
Sure. So, you know, one website that comes to mind, you know, a person doesn't, to just start off, a person really doesn't need to have an attorney. But, you know, one benefit that an attorney can can offer is to really, you know, they've been doing this before. So they can kind of ask the questions of the person that caused them to think of their mind. You know, what a person's decision is really so based on what they actually want. So it's not necessarily where, okay, they're going to bring a lawsuit and the law says certain things, you know, and they would need an attorney for that. This is way more of a personal decision. There are some basic frameworks in online and, you know, that can help kind of ask the questions that someone may want against health care directive. And, you know, if someone doesn't have the money, one aspect and one website that I would suggest someone look into, and of course, we don't endorse any specific type of, you know, organization per se, but this Caring Info is in a program of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. Is to help people make decisions about end-of-life care and services before a crisis. So, you know, that they do have a section on their website called Advanced Care Planning, and it kind of gives some more of an overview and can already help someone start to give, you know, a context and understanding of what that actually might mean. Communicate a person's end-of-life wishes. Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, everybody. It was great listening to all the information shared, and I think it's time to wrap up our call. So, ladies and gentlemen, we were listening to Shelley Rosenfeld of Cancer Legal Resource Center simplify for us the various legal issues related to continuing employment, accessing government benefits, and taking medical leave while going through cancer treatment. Shelley, thank you so very much for your time and educating us about all these really important and relevant issues, like, you know, issues with employers, how to approach the employers discussing accommodations at workplace, and assistance available for patients struggling with paying rent, mortgages, and different types of disability insurance, and so much more. Thank you so much for all the information. And we hope the information shared will be helpful for folks dealing with cancer diagnosis. Matt and Cindy and the audience, thank you so much for your insightful questions that brought out a very informative discussion this afternoon. The talk will be available on qtalks.com. Please visit our website for more details on upcoming talks. Until next time, thank you, everyone. Have a great day and stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.